sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle, Anna, Jordan. How are you doing today? Did you enjoy this beautiful fall day? Maybe you went to Calabash. Maybe you're still at Eat the View. It was a great weekend, really pretty sort of glistening and bright after that wonderful rain we had on Friday night. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. We have one guest this evening, somebody I've been wanting to talk to on this end of the microphone for a long time. It is Marcy Smothers, host of host and producer.
Thank you.
And creator of Food Guy and Marcy. And also, it's Remick Ridge Vineyards, right?
It's Remick Ridge Vineyards, and then it's Smothers Winery.
Great. And you brought a bottle, and I think that's what we should talk about first.
Okay. It's the Cabernet Sauvignon. It's the vintage 2000.
And Remick Ridge, it's Kenwood, right?
It's in Kenwood. Uh-huh. When my husband bought the property, it was with his grandfather, Ed Remick, and he was about 1972. He was looking everywhere in Sonoma County for some property, and actually Peter Haywood had befriended Tom and said, you've got to see this property. It's the top of the ridge in the Sonoma Valley in Kenwood, and Tom named it for his grandfather, Ed Remick, who lived with him on the ranch until he died. He actually died on the ranch with Tom with him. And so we took Grandpa's ashes and we put him in our drip system. So every glass of Remick Ridge Cabernet has a little bit of Grandpa Remick in it.
That's so sweet. And you specialize in the Bordeaux varieties.
Well, we, you know, initially when we were planted, it was Sauvignon Blanc and Cabernet and Merlot and Chardonnay. Then when the Phylloxera came in and we were hit like everybody else was, which is an interesting story in itself. Because when Tom was planting the vineyard, he did a lot of research and he wanted to plant it in the St. George stock, root stock.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone was saying, Davis, 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 you know, XR1, XR1. So he did it. You know, St. George never, ever got Phylloxera. Yeah. We did. So it was a protracted, long process. It's very expensive. Yeah. And as we were replanting, we decided to become 100% Cabernet because we're a hillside vineyard, mm-hmm. and we are the largest reserve grower for the Arrowwood Reserve Cabernet. So that's primarily what we do is we grow for the Arrowwood program, mm-hmm. and we make about 300 cases a year ourselves. Mm-hmm. For a limited time, we had Merlot, which is my wedding present. Tom gave me a vineyard, a five-acre parcel, and it was named Marcy's Merlot. And until 1999, that existed, and then with the Phylloxera, we ripped it out. So there's no more Merlot. The last vintage is the 1999 vintage of the Merlot. If you taste our wine, the Smothers Remick Ridge wine, which you can taste at our tasting room in Kenwood on Highway 12 and Warm Springs Road. Kenwood Restaurant carries it. Saddles carries it. A few restaurant saddles in Sonoma. You can still find the Cabernet, but for the most part, we grow, and I'm proudly growing for the Arrowwood.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's here, first
toast.
Of all, welcome to Mouthful.
Thank you. Oh, wait, there we go. Thrilled to be at Mouthful. It's 100% varietal, by the way, Michelle. We don't have anything else in it. There's no Merlot. There's no blending wines. Estate grown. Arrowwood Wine Master produces it.
It's got those pretty black pepper notes that I really, that's one of my favorite qualities in a Cabernet is that black pepper, sort of the high notes of black pepper. And this is definitely there. It's also really, so what year is it? What vintage?
This is 2000, actually.
Okay. I was going to say, it's really, the tannins are really smooth.
I hope so.
Yeah, they're really, really
it's
smooth
been a few
and soft.
Years.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's my favorite vintage right now, so that's why I brought it to you.
It's really nice.
And now, may I say something about you?
Okay.
Right to it. So I was having lunch with Molly Katzen the other day.
Now, did she come up here for your radio show, which we will be talking about very shortly?
And She is, of course, the author of the Moosewood Cookbook, which was inducted into the James Beard Cookbook Hall of Fame 2 years ago, along with her new books, Vegetable Dishes I Can't Live Without, and Salads, and, you know, Enchanted Forest. So I said to her, I'm going to be on Michelle's show. And she said, you know what, Marcy? Michelle Anna Jordan is the next MFK Fisher.
Wow, that's
awfully
sweet.
This is coming from Molly Katzen. And it actually gives me goosebumps saying it, because I actually have so much respect for you. You write so beautifully, so articulately, so literally, so passionately, with humor. I just can't wait every day in the Press Democrat to pick up your column and see, what am I making for dinner? Because if you write about it, I know I have to have it that night. I probably can't go 24 hours if you've written about it without cooking it.
Monica, do the recipes work?
They do, but you know, I distinguish myself as a home cooker. My partner, my co-host, Guy Fieri, is a professional chef. He went to culinary school. He has 5 restaurants. Obviously, he's a star on the Food Network. I try to be very careful that I am not even a gourmet cook. I'm a home cooker, and that's a term I made up myself because I need to follow recipes. I can't be a Michelle. I'm not going to go and pick things from the garden and see what I happen to have in the refrigerator and create this beautiful meal. It's just not the way I'm made up. But give me a recipe, I can follow it in pretty much perfection and still stun my guests. So,
well, I really admire that, and that's in many ways how I think of myself. I mean, and if you think about cuisine and world cuisine and that sort of thing, nearly every cuisine in the world is based in the home. It's only the very few French cuisine, for example, that has its roots in the restaurant. So for a cuisine, and I write about this, I think, in California home cooking, I write about this. For a cuisine to really endure through many decades and many centuries, it has to be in the domain of the home, which puts it into the domain of women who are charged with feeding their families and have done that for centuries and centuries, which is not saying anything about men not cooking or anything like that. But that's where, I mean, you look at some of the great books, say, about Italy, like Carol Field's book, in Nona's Kitchen. It's all about going and getting those original recipes from the those heritage recipes from the grandmothers that, as people turn more and more because of busy life, turn more and more to restaurants because of time, some of that culinary history is in danger of fading away. But it's the home cook that keeps traditions moving. So you do exactly what I am interested in. And when I wrote my book, A Cook's Tour of Sonoma, I didn't call it a chef's tour. I called it a cook's tour, and that's really how I think of myself. I'm a cook. Everything I do is tested in a home kitchen, that sort of thing.
How many times do you test a recipe before you'll print it?
It really depends. There are certain things, and when you've been cooking for a long time, and I think that this is true for anyone who's really been involved with food for a long time, you acquire a lot of knowledge. It's just like speaking. You know, if you've studied French after 30 years, you know your vocabulary, you know the structure, and it's sort of, you just talk. And in certain things, that's how I am with food. There are just certain things I know that they work. I can walk into the kitchen, I can cook them and take a few notes, and I know exactly how I do it. Now, if there's something brand new, I may do something once, and I have enough knowledge to know if that works or not. I may do something 2 or 3 or 4 times to actually get it exactly right, because I want it to work in a home kitchen. I want it to be a reasonable thing to do. And I also want people to feel flexible with it. You know, recipes used to be passed on almost like gossip, like a game of telephone.
Exactly.
If you get those, 100-year-old cookbooks, and I have one from it's like the San Rafael Ladies Cookbook or something like that from 1901. They're just little paragraphs. You know, there's 4 or 5 sentences, 7 or 8 at most, and it tells you how it's done, but not with like a quarter cup of this and half a teaspoon of this. So it's really more of a narrative way of doing things.
And I understand a lot of the Nonas didn't read or write.
No.
So it took a long time to be able to get their recipes passed down so we could actually have them to follow, which is fascinating to me.
Yeah, and they were passed down probably from their nonas. They're passed down standing next to each other at the stove and just acquiring really a lifetime of knowledge. So, and I'm hoping there's some suggestion And I think there always is a sort of rises and falls, but there's some suggestion that that way of cooking is coming back into favor.
Do you think that's part of the slow cooking movement?
No, I think slow cooking actually is an adjunct of that. Mm-hmm. I think actually it's a natural thing that we could expect to see in various ways, and I think slow food is one of the forms that it's taking. But I know a book just came across my desk a couple days ago. I can't even remember the title. But it's all about you don't need recipes. You don't need measuring spoons. Let's just cook.
Play.
Let's just cook. There's some basic things you need to know. If you haven't acquired that knowledge during your childhood, and you know, if you're new to the kitchen, if you're new to cooking, there's some basic knowledge that you need. Other than that, relax. Relax. And I think that's an important thing. Relax and taste.
Yeah, I've just learned that recently, which is, you know, again, as a home cooker, you absolutely need to taste along the way. You know, I used to be the type of person, I mean, a few years ago, where I would follow the recipe, and I would never think to sample it. Mm-hmm. And now, as I sample it, I'm so much more cautious and so much more selective about what I'm adding to my food, because I'm just little taste. I always know I can add more later. It seems like so basic. You can't take it away, but you can always add.
Yes, very true. And that's one thing I always tell people. And when I'm teaching cooking, it's like, okay, put down your notebook. You know, now we're going to cook. Now add a little bit of salt now before you put in the next ingredients. Now taste it. See how it tastes. And eventually you do just, I really think language is a good parallel, because it's so hard at certain stages to learn a language, I find. And then all of a sudden you go over a watershed and suddenly you're dreaming in French. And you sort of acquire that naturally. And I think in many ways cooking sort of progresses in the same way. I want to take a little musical break. We're going to come back and talk about your radio show. Well, I sort of lied. We are going to talk about the radio show, but first, because of that song I just played, Lady Bacon by the Guanabats, I had to say that you made a magnificent Mayo Queen.
It was my honor to be a Mayo Queen.
We did a 56-foot BLT on Tuesday to feed attendees of the California Tourism Conference that were here for CalTIA Travel. I forget what it stands for. It's a California Travel
Something advisory people's.
Yeah, and yeah. People from all over the county, and it was Sonoma County's job, Santa Rosa Tourism, I believe, or Sonoma County Convention and Visitors Bureau. It was their job to feed people on Tuesday night, and they didn't want to do the standard issue hotel food, because even if it's good, you know, it's hotel banquet food. So we made a 56-foot BLT, and no big BLT, I don't think, can really exist without the blessing of the Mayo Queen. And Marcy, you
with
made
the golden spatula.
The golden spatula. You made a fabulous Mayo Queen. Well, so thank you very much.
You're welcome. I mean, the BLT, your BLT cookbooks very prominently in my shelf. And I learned more about the art, love, passion of a BLT from you. Just your describing the process and the creamy goodness of the mayonnaise and the critical layering and to be sure.
Absolutely.
Oh, and the salting. Oh, my goodness. And all those people at the Flamingo were rushing up. They were so excited it was a BLT for dinner. I don't think they realized it. They thought it was a show. You know, a
they
lot
did.
Of
they
them,
did. They didn't realize it was going to be dinner.
And then they got to eat that. I saw people go 3, 4, 5 times back.
Yeah, it was great. And there's a video up on YouTube now of it. I'm going to send you the link. But there's a video. You figure prominently in the video. It's great fun. So thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you.
Now, the food guy in Marcy. And the food guy refers to Guy Fieri, Sonoma County. And now on the big star on the Food Network. When did the show start?
Well, when I was doing the KSRO show here in Sonoma County, that was about 4 years ago, I was plucked from obscurity. I received a phone call from Brian Hudson, who was then the program director, and he said he was looking for a new local host to do a Monday through Friday show. And I naturally assumed that he was, you know, fishing to see if Tom would be interested. And I said, there's no way Tom's going to do that. He said, no, I mean you. Do you want to try out? I really didn't want to do it, Michelle. I didn't speak publicly until 5 years ago, thanks to Dale Carnegie training that I had right here in Sonoma County. I think the one time that the Dale Carnegie course has been here in over 10 years was offered about 5 years ago, and it was one of the best things I've ever done, because I really couldn't even speak in front of three or four people with any animation or any candid, being able to be candid. So I went and I did the show on KSRO. I didn't know that Guy had wanted that job also. 75 people applied.
Now, which show?
This was it was a spot that I had from 9 to noon on KSRO a couple years ago. They're trying to bring live and local programming back to Sonoma County. And I got the job. And I really didn't want it, but that's how the universe kind of works, you know. And so a friend of mine who has since passed away had told me, take the cookies when they're passed. Mm-hmm. Take the cookies when they're passed. And so many times I turned it down. It's not da, da, da. And I just heard him say that to me, and I decided this was an opportunity. I couldn't miss the chance to do live radio. So during my show, Guy then, about a year into it, was on the reality show, the next Food Network star. And like everybody else, it wasn't just me. It was Chris Smith. It was Brent Ferris. It was Blazy. I mean, everybody just had Guy on. Vote, vote, vote. Disable your cookies so you could vote more times than once. And then Guy would be on the show, and we would get off the air, and we'd say, that was so much fun. We just had this sort of yin-yang. We're complete opposites. Mm-hmm. So we immediately started talking about doing something together. And I did some little research and a little bit of due diligence, and I found there really wasn't a national food, wine, lifestyle show with a male-female host where we lived in the wine country, came to you from the wine country, and wanted to have permission to have fun. We didn't want to be staid. We didn't want to be droll. We didn't want to take ourselves too seriously. Luckily, I just kept hooking up, and I had a barn, a costume, and a friend, and the next thing, the next layer, and the next layer, and the mortar, and the bricks, 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 and now we have a nationally syndicated show.
That's magnificent. How many stations do you know?
Well, right now we're on 10 stations, but I'm entertaining offers from networks, which is very exciting. So I hope to have great news in early 2009 about being all over the country, over 100 stations to start.
Really?
Yeah.
That is just great. And this is it AM or does it vary? When you syndicate, it can be on either, right?
It can be on either. I think what I found was, you know, traditionally it's a news talk show on an AM's format because that's what's built for the type of clock that we have. In other words, when the commercials are. But here in Sonoma County, KZST carries it on a FM station. And I think that if you're appealing to the type of demographic that we are, your everyday people, 25 to 64, everybody that cooks, cares about wine, wants to eat, wants to lose weight, wants to go out to dinner, likes to travel, that's everybody. You know, you need to do the FM, AM mix in order to reach them. But it's been incredibly helpful with Guy's popularity. You know, he is absolutely adds so much value to the show because as he travels around the country now with Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, he's gaining culinary knowledge that just keeps adding and adding and adding to the program all the time.
And he's making a lot of contacts in all
making
those areas so people will tune in. They'll look for the show.
It's all good. It comes down to friendship and relationship.
Uh-huh. So when do you record? How do you record? How does that work?
Well, we started out being a live show like you are, Michelle, and I prefer live. I mean, after KSRO, I was on KGO for a year filling in, and I love live radio. For me, there's nothing like no net. You know, do
exactly.
A triple somersault and just it fails or it works, you know?
You jump out of the plane. You hope your parachute opens.
Absolutely. But as Guy became more popular and there were more demands on his time with the Food Network, we had to rethink the live. And also, you can't really deliver to multiple of people across the country at the same time. They would record it anyway and play it to their own desire. So now we record at the Kendall Jackson Wine Center about 8 times a year. And we do 2 days of just super hard work, record people back to back. You've been a guest, which I think is really ironic, as you're on our show tonight with your oil and vinegar cookbook. It's kind of fun. And we just make it work.
Uh-huh.
We just make it work. But for me, it's the eclecticism. I like to think of our show as a variety show of food and wine. You know, this time we're going to talk about the championship eater, Joey the Chestnut, you know, the guy that eats more hot dogs than anybody.
Right.
Then the next moment we might have BLT. Uh-huh. The next moment we might talk about the hot new wine, that'd be Malbec. And we just sort of keep revolving the topic so that if something in 5 minutes doesn't hit your fancy, just wait 5 more minutes. We're going to be talking about something you want to know.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a musical break. You're listening to Mouthful. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. Thanks for sticking with us. We are talking with Marcy Smothers, creator, producer, host of Food Guy and Marcy, currently heard on 10 stations and soon to be heard on 10 times that or more. Also has Remick Ridge Vineyard Smothers Winery. Got that right. We are sipping the 2000 Sonoma Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. Quite a lovely wine. What's the current release?
The current release actually is right up to 2003, because we're such a small winery. Mm-hmm. We sell ours and library ours for a long time.
That is, bless you for that. You know, that I really was sad when that trend to release, especially Cabernet, to release Cabernet so early.
So early. Yeah. Well, you know, it's the ultra-premium wine market. It's tough. It's really tough. And I really don't pretend to know that much about it, because mm-hmm. we're so small, we're able to sell our wine through our tasting room and to our friends' restaurants and to people that subscribe to a club, per se, which is really an unofficial club that we have. But I agree with you. What I like more than anything else, Michelle, and I travel enough across the country, is to support Sonoma County wineries. I don't think I have purchased, and I don't mean it in any disrespect at all to Napa, I don't think I've bought anything from Napa personally for at least 10 years, and I don't think Tom has either. I really feel it's very important to support our local wineries. And what I found moving up here, I went to film school at UCLA, and I immediately wanted to go into Davis and get my degree in enology, because I've always loved wine. My family was non-cookers. I mean, basic, you know, chicken, rice, broccoli type of food. But there was always, like, Gallo Hardy Burgundy on the table, mm-hmm. you know. And I was able to taste it, and pretty soon I thought the best thing in the world would be able to afford in college a 750-milliliter real bottle of wine. You know, to me, that was living large. And after I graduated from film school, and I had grown up in the business pretty much, I thought, maybe this isn't what I want to do. I spent my last year in film school actually on the set of MASH. It was the final year of MASH. My mentor was Charles Dubin, and I had met him. He offered that I could follow him for the entire final season of MASH, my last year of film school. And I'll tell you, it was the most magnificent opportunity, but it also taught me I didn't want to direct. I didn't want to direct. I wasn't an actor. I thought I liked the idea of directing. But when I realized what really went into it and the intensity and the be able to work with actors in the cellular level, I didn't possess. So then I kind of reframed myself, and I worked as a casting director for a couple of years, as an assistant first and ultimately to a casting director, and was harboring this desire to move up to the wine country and work in wine. Unfortunately, at that time, 20 years ago, enology is strictly a science degree. And I was I had a fine arts degree from UCLA. Mm-hmm. So there was no way I was going to be able to go to get my master's in wine. I've digressed terribly, but hopefully it'll come around. It's
fine.
So tangential. It'll come back one full circle.
Mouthful is all digression. It's just
so
perfect.
When I met Tom and we got married, and that was in 1990, and I moved up here, what impressed me about the wine country, that people actually grow and make wine, was they're incredibly down to earth. I'll never forget my experience. We were first married going to the Kenwood restaurant exactly this time. eating outside. It was harvest time. All of the farmers, all of the ranchers, all the vineyard workers were sitting around having hamburgers with a bottle of red wine on their table at lunch. And I thought, how terribly civilized. I mean, I don't think I knew what civilized was, but I felt it, you know. Mm-hmm. And everybody was bringing wine over and sharing it. And everyone had to go back to work for another 5 or 6 hours, but it was just that siesta, that hour in the middle of the day to celebrate harvest. And that's when I knew I love the wine country. I love Sonoma County. And I guess that comes around to my idea of, you know, I do try to be very careful about buying Sonoma County wines anywhere I travel in the country. I think it's important.
Mm-hmm. And I've always done it since I first moved here. I moved here a very long time ago, always connected with Sonoma County. But I've always liked our wines. If you think about that taste of place, mm-hmm. I mean, Sonoma County is a really diverse thing. And we have more cooler climates than Napa, and I've always been very attracted to cool climate wines.
What's your favorite wine?
What's my favorite wine?
Varietal, should I say.
Oh, varietal, I have to choose Pinot Noir.
Me too. You know, I know. I'm just sort of on a Pinot tear right now.
Yeah, yeah. I became fascinated with Pinot Noir in 1990 after I finally got to France. I had been trying to get to France for a long time, and I finally got there. And when I came back, I sort of knew something about myself that I couldn't have described, but I could find my way around wine with my palate. And I was one of those people mm-hmm. who gets big red wine headaches. And I learned in France, I drank a lot of Beaujolais, started drinking it because it was cheap, and then it's like, hey, I'm not getting a headache. I like this.
Exactly.
So I came back, and Beaujolais isn't something you really see much here. You can see a little bit of it, but not a lot. And when I couldn't find it, I tried a Pinot Noir. And lo and behold, after drinking Pinot Noir for about a year, got to know that varietal really well, really understood a lot about, at least taste-wise, how a wine gives you headaches. And then I just fell in love with the varietal.
Wait a minute. In other words, when you're tasting the wine, you can predict that this is the type of heavy wine that's going to give you a headache?
Oh, yeah, I can tell.
What are your descriptors?
There's a darkness. You've probably heard some people say that in blind tastings. I heard some people on some mainstream radio saying, oh, this business of red and white. Most tasters can't tell the color of the wine if you make them taste it blind. That is so not true.
I think even this home cooker could do that.
Yeah, it's just so not true. Well, in that same way, and I think partly it was compiling knowledge because I tasted lots of different wines for about 2 years. And I knew I could, and over that time, I could tell you, I can taste. And partly it's a darkness. Some of it has to do with the quality of the tannins, mm-hmm. the degree of the tannins, the length, the harshness. But I can tell with one sip, I can drink that wine. No, I can't drink that wine. I can taste it, but I can't drink it. And I can pretty much do the same thing with white wines as well. And I will react to certain Pinot Noirs, but that's only been in the last few years as they've been over-extracted. And I was having dinner with Abundance Winery. Do you know Abundance? They're over in the Kenwood, Glen Ellen area. They have the most beautiful Pinot Noir, and I was sitting next to the winemaker, and I hope I have this right, he had written a dissertation for his PhD at Davis about the chemical components of Pinot Noir and this particular phenomenon. And according to him, there are two compounds in red wine that are responsible in part for pigmentation. Pinot Noir does not have those two compounds. And so he did some investigation about those compounds being one of the primary triggers for red wine headaches.
Interesting.
And as I teach all over, sometimes all over the country, sometimes just all over the Bay Area, one of the questions I get a lot of, sometimes men, but a lot of women, especially women, say in their 50s and 60s, who say, no, 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 I can't drink red wine. Because I get headaches, and I will refer these women to, I'll have like 5 or 6 different Pinots to tell them to try, and I'll get emails and cards from them saying, you've changed my life. I can drink red wine.
And it's so versatile on top of that.
Yeah, and then, yeah, you got that out of the way. And then you get to how incredibly versatile Pinot Noir is. Mm-hmm. It will go with almost anything, especially one that is made true to varietal. And then on top of that, there's the Pinot thing. And if you like Pinot Noir, you know about the Pinot thing. I call it pinescence, a word I just popped out of my mouth at a tasting once. And it's that sexy, engaging, it starts as an aroma, but it also translates onto the palate. Not every Pinot Noir has it, but no other wine. Pinot Noir is the only one that has it. And it's that little quality that makes me, anyway, want to fall to my knees and sob with joy.
I was going to say my taste buds jump, but, you know.
There's that, too. But it's just, it's so ephemeral, ethereal, engaging, sexy, mysterious. I just love it. Just love that.
Michelle, how do you think Sideways affected Pinot Noir?
Well, it's certainly... made a lot of people talk about it and made me cringe because suddenly this movie gets credit for this passion for Pinot Noir that I'd been talking about and writing about for over a decade. It certainly got people's attention, and interestingly, it shifted attention, of course, to Southern California.
And Paso Robles. And,
yeah, and actually down there, there are some spectacular vineyards, and they have a very, very pretty style. So I sort of have mixed feelings. Okay, well, down there, they're getting the attention. But that leaves more up here for me. Because I do think Russian River in particular, I think Russian River, you know, is one of the best places on the planet for Pinot Noir.
May I ask you something about your palate?
Sure.
Do you have something like an eidetic palate? Can you taste something and remember it?
Yes.
Oh, man.
I've done that since I was a little kid.
Oh, man. That's like being like the what's the person? Now I'm lost for words. Oh, I'll think of it. The kid that can recall everything. I mean, eidetic palate is so fascinating to me because I'm the opposite. Like Robert Parker has an eidetic palate. I believe Richard Arrowood has an eidetic palate. It's extremely rare to be
really?
Able to taste something and write. But I knew it. I felt it somewhere.
I've had that since I was a little kid. I just took it for granted.
So you just remember something from 15 years ago. This reminds me of blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. I can remember things. I can remember this particular apple I ate. I think it was about October 27th. I was on Springs Road at the Safeway in Vallejo. My mother gave me some money to go in and buy something. And one of the things I got was this red delicious apple. And I remember the size. As I tell you about it, I can see it, I can feel it, I can see everything about it, and I know exactly what that taste was when I bit into it. And I was probably 7 or 8 years old.
I can see the cover of the New York Times Book Review, Eidetic Palate by Michelle Anna Jordan. Here's a high five. I can't even imagine, because I'm really not that, Michelle. I'm just not. I enjoy every taste. I'm part of the conversation, the conviviality, the opportunity, getting down to the just chilling, being with friends, or I really enjoy the cooking process. For me, it is my meditation, that and running. When I run, it's my meditation, and when I cook, it's my meditation. These are my times where I zero in on what's important to me. It feels kind of selfish, and my kids will tell you, my son Beau's right here. Sometimes I'll shoo him out of the kitchen. You know, this is my time. You know, let me chop in peace. In fact, if my husband comes and wants to help me sometimes in the kitchen, I resent it.
No.
Because it's my – and he knows that. I don't mean that in a –
sure, no, but
when
you get into that.
But that's like my little cone of silence. It's like my little zone. And that chopping, I never understood wanting to buy pre-chopped items, other than on taco night when I'm working. because it's that zen, don't you think, of the chopping, of the work.
You just lose your... I find it absolutely mesmerizing. And I've written several columns about this. You know, in times of trouble, one of the things you can do is just forget about it, go into the kitchen, and lose yourself in the process of cooking. And that's one of the things I think is so great about that is when you have, number one, a good knife. A good knife that feels good in your hand so that you don't have, you know, you're not handicapped
and
by
don't
that
under-knife.
Awkwardness.
I'm an under-knifer. I underknife.
You underknife?
I underknife. I've learned that. I tend to use a small paring knife because it feels, I've got small hands, it feels good, but it's not the most efficient tool.
No, you need a sharp knife, efficient knife, but one that feels good in your hand, and then you just lose yourself in cooking. You don't worry about the results, and you're not hurried to get done. You just lose yourself in the sensuality of it. And by the time you're done, things will be a little bit different. You'll feel differently. So I love that mesmerizing quality of cooking. It cures all manner of ills. But I wanted to talk about the radio show. And one of the things you have, and I noticed that the first time we met, first of all, you're just so bubbly and full of life. But part of what that conveys to me is you just have a genuine curiosity about everything that comes in front of you.
I do, and thank you for saying that. If I had to describe myself, I would say I'm an ordinary person with extraordinary curiosity, and I'm so proud of that because it defines me. I can't go a day without wanting to read a lot of newspapers, talk with people. I was in China for the Olympics.
Probably, you were?
Yeah, I was. Yes, with Bo and
my gosh.
Kids. Yes, it was incredible in Beijing. My best time was trying to communicate with the locals, and our host was always pulling me away because I was swarmed. Once you start talking, people were swarming and wanted to talk with me. He was trying to pull me to get to the next venue. I couldn't get enough of culture and learning more about cultures that I don't know about, and the foods, and particularly, again, the people and their passions, their compassions. So for me, curiosity is key, and I think in life, but certainly for a radio show, when I'm trying to deliver an eclectic variety show on food, wine, and lifestyle with two hosts that are diametrically opposed and keep it interesting, you have to be curious. Because my mantra has always been, whether it's talk radio on KSRO or KGO or now Food Guy and Marcy, if it interests me, it's going to interest the listener. Because if I get excited about
Absolutely.
It, I got to believe that other people would be excited about it. And there's some sort of cool element of knowing about something before other people do, you know, and saying, you know, did you know that? You know, for instance, let's say, oh, here's the new thing I learned. Do you know what sommeliers are called now? Psalms. They're just psalms. The wine psalm, you know, I should never, no, you never snap fingers, sorry. Water psalm. Tea sommeliers, which we have on our show, Heyman Deleuze. If you want an incredible experience, and I only say things on the air, my show, your show, that I mean, Aroma Tea Shop on Clement in San Francisco, Heyman Deleuze. He is a tea sommelier, or tea somm. That experience of learning and tasting tea, sitting at his little shop, is one of the most profound experiences you'll ever have. I did not know that there were so many nuances to tea.
Oh, I love tea, and there's I love tea. Yeah. I've done several shows on tea, and there's a tea tasting, little tea tasting bar on Jackson. It's open, and then there's this low bar,
right?
And there are these guys, one in particular from Malaysia, and they are constantly pouring. You ask about something, they suddenly pull it off the shelf.
Yeah, anything you want.
Yeah. But I don't know this one. I will definitely. Yeah, I love tea. We did a show on Pu'er tea here that changed my life.
Pu'er?
Pu'er.
Pu'er. Okay.
Pu'er is an aged fermented tea from China. And up until that point, I had been drinking British-style tea, which I fell in love with when I was in India a long time ago. And so milk and sugar and a nice, big, bold black tea. I had a cup of Pu'er, and I've never looked back. I drink 3 or 4 cups of Pu'er tea every morning, and I search for the really good Pu'er teas from, you know, wherever I can find them. So I will check this guy out, definitely.
Mm.
How'd you find him?
I found him, same thing, ordinary person with extraordinary curiosity, mm-hmm. just reading. I read an article in the San Francisco Chronicle. Another guy that I found, Bo Timken, he's a sake.
Oh, he's been on Mouthful.
Show. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Sake samurai. He's the only American sake samurai. Mm-hmm. And he works so diligently to educate everybody about sake and introducing it with Western cuisine. So I read about it. He came up on the show, and his whole thing is take a bottle of sake like you would take a bottle of wine to a restaurant. Just do it, you know, and start tasting it the reverse way. Introduce sake into your life. And I just, when you meet people like him that are so clearly devoted to something, he's got a retail store. I think it's on Hayes Street in San Francisco.
Yeah, I think
his education component is more important to him than anything else. And so by the end of our time together, I was dubbed the Sake Ninja. So this is a term of endearment and responsibility.
Sake Ninja.
Very seriously. So if you see me in Sonoma County at the various sushi bars, you know I'm a Sake Ninja, and I'm licensed to do this.
Oh, that's so great. So it's October now. Harvest over for you?
No, we've got one small parcel that hasn't been picked yet. But usually we're very late into October, so the intense heat of this summer certainly accelerated our harvest. And we had some grapes off mid-September, which I don't recall happening for a long time. We still have about 10 acres we have to replant from the phylloxera debacle. And when we're done, we'll have 40 acres total planted. Mm-hmm. Again, 100% in Cabernet. But because of our microclimates and our hillside, at one point we're extremely steep, the vineyards can come off, even just at the Cabernet varietal, much less when we had 3 or 4 varietals, within 6 weeks apart.
Oh, okay.
And your listeners probably know, but when it's really a hot day, we'll test the grapes 4 times a day. I mean, that's mm-hmm. how critical it is. And it could be the third time, no, third time at 1 o'clock, and the sugars are not quite right, and then 4 o'clock, and you just hope that you have the team to come and take off the grapes. Mm-hmm. It's that fast. And I, one thing that I've learned, I don't know if you probably have had this, but I hadn't. I learned this at Trevenier, particularly with white wine. If you can get some white wine, white grapes, that doesn't matter what varietal, that were just crushed, and make a cure with some sparkling wine.
Oh, it's so good.
To me, it is the nectar of the gods. And it really signifies this is harvest. You can't mm-hmm. have this any other time of year because the juice can't preserve like
that. It's so wonderful.
So delectable. So if you're, I don't know how much white wine's left on the vines, but if you can get some white wine and go to your local winery and ask them if you could just have a cup or two of that, take it home, you're going to stun your guests.
Yeah, I had that in a restaurant last harvest season. It was just really, it was Chardonnay and then sparkling wine. They served it for a cocktail 2 or 3 mm-hmm. times. So at this time of year, in addition to harvest, what are some of the things, just as a home cook, feeding your family, having friends over, what are some of the things you're really enjoying and looking forward to enjoying this season?
Well, now I'm looking forward to making polenta now that you've given me your polenta cookbook. I really am, because I've kind of rediscovered polenta. I'll be honest with you, this is a time when I have been really so busy with my career. I'm probably doing the least amount of mm-hmm. cooking that I've done in a long time. Back in the day when my kids were little and I was a stay-at-home mom, they would watch Arthur, you know, on the TV in the kitchen and have their chocolate milk and bows here. And that would keep them occupied. Then Dragon Tales, you know, that would keep them occupied for an hour. And I found the time. Now I've got a 15-year-old, a 12-year-old. Tom's on the road 6 months, a year. So I'm committed to the family meal, by the way. Every time that we are as a family together, we try to have dinner, which is at least 5 times a week. But it's become simpler and simpler and simpler.
Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with simple.
Yeah.
Nothing
but
at
me,
all.
A roast chicken with Meyer lemon reduction would be just delicious. The tomatoes coming online, I'm making a lot of, you know, tomato-based things, a cacciatore or a tomato mm-hmm. sauce. I love fish. I really adore it. So whatever fish is there, I'll just grill it with a simple, you know, again, a simple salad. And I'm a vegetabilist.
That's right. We have to talk about vegetabilist.
Yes.
This is a term you and Molly Katzen coined.
Well, I made it up and Molly joined my club, so I'm so honored that Molly Katzen would join my club. The two original things I've ever done in my life, well, at least with Food Guy and Marcy, is to distinguish myself as a home cooker, which is very clearly different than a cook and a gourmet cook, and a vegetabilist, because about 2 years ago I made a decision to get in good shape, great shape. And I don't want to say I let myself go, but I let myself go. So I went from 26% body fat to less than 18. Actually, I'm almost less than 17 right now. And I don't weigh myself. I've been anorexic and bulimic. I did it through exercise, and I didn't like it at the time, but now I adore exercise, and through changing the way I ate. And I'll tell you, Michelle, at the time when I was asked by the person that I hired to make a food diary, I was a little bit offended. Well, I eat very healthily. But I hadn't realized 100 calories here, 100 calories there, mm-hmm. 100 calories there, how it adds up. So I started just adding more and more green. I've always loved veggies. I always made the excuse that, well, it takes too much time. But I've learned it doesn't take too much time, and I can reflect on that from what Molly Katz has taught me. But I mean by vegetablist is 50% of what I try to eat every day are vegetables is green.
Uh-huh.
So in the morning, I'll have spinach, or I'll slice some zucchini with some tomatoes and garlic, one poached egg, even a green salad. I love that. For lunch, I try to have greens and some sort of fish. I eat a lot of sushi. If I have sushi, I'll try to have a salad. And dinner, back to the home front, what I would cook, at least for myself, is a salad, 2 veggies, and a protein. For my kids, and I will definitely make a starch. You know, I don't miss those. But that's sort of the commitment, and I've gotten to the point now that, and with Molly's help, Molly Katzen says, and I believe her because she's the goddess of vegetarian cooking, that if you take your vegetables home fresh, let's say on a Sunday tonight, and you actually blanch them, which is important. I know you know this, but that's a 2-step process. That's not just plunging them briefly in hot water. It's cooling them immediately in cold water, mm-hmm. ice bath. And you put them in a Ziploc bag, you will preserve the shelf life of the vegetable almost twice as much as if you had not done that before.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good tip.
Yeah. So it's 2 for the price of 1. Not only have you preserved the nutrients in your vegetables, but you've basically pre-cooked them and you've washed them and chopped them. So there's no excuse to say there's no time for veggies. I do that too. So I find convenience, and it's healthier and it's easier. So that's what I do. And I love it. But I don't think my kids love vegetables as much as me.
And they, you know, there's some they'll get to. You know, they have time. They'll love vegetables a little bit later.
Bo does. My son does. My daughter Riley Rose is a little, you know, persnickety. And the other thing that Molly Katzen said, and I'm sure you can appreciate it because I'm sitting here with the next award-winning author of The Eidetic Palate by Michelle Ed Jordan. I don't know how many cookbooks, but I do read a lot because, mm-hmm. again, that's part of my job, and I'm a voracious reader anyway. Most cookbooks, I find, when you're talking about roasting vegetables in the oven, will say to salt them first. And Molly has taught me, never, ever, because it's drawing the moisture out. And it partly ties into what you were saying earlier about taste as you cook. So now, and I love roasting vegetables, I'll roast vegetables, and I'll eat them 2 and 3 days later. I'll make my Brussels sprout hash, which is one of my original recipes. There are very few. And I will eat that 2 or 3 days later. But I have found that I never salt to the end now when I'm roasting. I never salt to the end. And it works for me. Works for Molly Katzen. Let's drop her name another time. Molly.
I love Molly. Molly's wonderful. I've got to get her back up here. It's been a couple of years since she was on, but she's always been one of Mouthful's favorite guests. And it's really good to hear she's doing well. So we are just about out of time because we do a weekly book review. We have a fabulous reviewer, Laura Hager. And so we're going to be going to that in just a second. But for people who are listening in Sonoma County, KZST is where they should...
KZST at 7 p.m. But if you go to foodguyandmarcy.com, that's one word, Marcy, with a Y. You can find it also. You can listen to us online, or you can listen to us at our San Francisco affiliate. There's a huge 50,000-watt signal that reaches here in Sonoma County, so that's 3 to 5.
And which one is the San Francisco? What's the San Francisco?
It's 860 a.m.
860 a.m. What are the call letters on?
KTRB.
KTRB. And to listen online, you just go to your website.
Just go to our website.
You can do like a listen now sort of thing.
Well, you can listen online with our affiliates, and we have music on demand. We have our shows on demand. We have an archive of a month.
Oh, okay, great.
And that actually will be up and running by about October 15th, because the site's undergoing a major haul so that we can make it more user-friendly and adding some more stuff. And if you go to foodguyandmarcy.com, my Marcy's Video Adventure blog is there, my YouTube channel, and you can see all my stuff from China, but also what we recorded just a few days ago with Guy in the studio, including the potato chip challenge will be up there.
I look forward to the potato chip challenge. So that is the Food Guy in Marcy. It is, of course, with Guy Fieri, hometown boy turned famous.
Yeah.
Marcy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate the time. I love the wine.
Thank you very
And
much.
I look forward to talking to you about you more too. Good things to eat and drink soon on Food Guy in Marcy or here on Mouthful. Okay, we've got book review coming up for you. Meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. Have a great week. I'm writing about the book I read. I have to sing about the book I read. I came upon a book in my local bookstore, which I feel compelled to review because its central premise flies so boldly in the face of foodie political correctness. In an age when eating locally is a measure of one's virtue, Movable Feasts author Sarah Murray has dedicated an entire book to the technologies which have, through the centuries, allowed food to travel vast distances from field to table. Subtitled, From Ancient Rome to the 21st Century, The Incredible Journeys of the Food We Eat, the book jets back and forth through time and across the globe, bringing us histories of foods like olive oil, bananas, wheat, and tea, staples whose very existence as commodities depends on a global marketplace. I can't say I actually enjoyed Movable Feasts. It's rather hard going, but there is something bracing about Murray's cold-eyed realism. There's no sun-kissed hills of Tuscany in this book, no noble Chiapan farmers nurturing their ancient maize crop, no biodynamic vintners from Sonoma. Instead, you'll find paeans to the Emma Maersk, the world's largest container ship, a history of the Berlin airlift, and a tribute to the Army food scientists who designed those indestructible ready-to-eat meals. Movable Feasts isn't really a food book, so much as a history of the fateful collision between food science and transportation. We learn about the tea trade and clipper ships, a history of the barrel, and the fact that Mongolians under Genghis Khan were the first to develop large-scale powdered milk production, yak milk, to keep the Mongol hordes on their feet.
One of the most interesting stories in the book is a profile of India's tiffin trade. Tiffin is an old British colonial word for the light lunch served at midday. In Mumbai, tiffin delivery men bring tens of thousands of just-cooked lunches from Indian housewives to their husbands' offices every day with an accuracy rate of 99.99999%, a feat that has brought American businessmen on pilgrimages to India to study the tiffin men's method as a way of improving efficiency back home. A cheerleader of globalization, Murray is deeply skeptical of the local foods movement. She dismisses environmental concerns about the lengthy journeys that many foods make, noting that car trips to a distant organic food market are often more environmentally harmful per unit of produce than buying food shipped in an efficient vessel like the Emma Maersk. And while globalization may be unpopular with progressives, poor farmers in Africa, blocked by farm subsidies from selling their produce in Europe and America, would leap at the chance to ship their crops a long distance to us. Movable Feasts is a reminder of the complexity of our food system. It's a needling antidote to foodie romanticism. Still, given the choice between two strawberries, one picked 7,000 miles away and airlifted in, and one picked that morning by a local farmer, I know which one I'm going to choose, and it's not the one racking up the frequent flyer miles. This is Laura Hager for Mouthful.
For Mouthful on KRCB comes from our members and from NetBooks, complete business management software for companies up to 50 people, including wineries and food producers. Information available at netbooks.com or by phone at 86-NETBOOKS. And from Traverso's Gourmet Foods and Wine, a family-owned purveyor serving customers for over 85 years with domestic and imported edibles and beverages in an old-world atmosphere in downtown Santa Rosa and online at traversos.com. We also have support from Peter Lowell's Cafe in Sebastopol, offering casual dining in the rustic Italian tradition, featuring seasonally sourced organic produce, serving brunch Saturday and Sunday with a farm prefix menu Sunday evening. Peter Lowell's Cafe, online at peterlowells.com. Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes. Dinner,